Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. More than 80 dignitaries from around the world and millions of average citizens flocked to the funeral of Pope John Paul II. We'll have more from the Vatican in a moment, but first, to Iraq. Four children were killed by a roadside bomb today as they collected trash in Baghdad. Yesterday, shortly after being sworn in as president, former Kurdish rebel leader Jalal Talabani appointed Shiite leader Ibrahim al-Jafari as prime minister, ending 2 months of divisive negotiations over the makeup of the country's government. On the line from Baghdad is reporter Jill Carroll of the Christian Science Monitor. Jill, to the appointments, what broke the two-month logjam?
Several things that happened over the past 2.5 weeks or so. The first thing was about 2.5 weeks ago, the Kurds, who have been demanding that various demands are specifically there in their interest, they want them to have resolved first. They decided they actually would be willing to delay resolution of some of those issues, like control of the northern city of Kirkuk, for example. And then about a week and a half later, during that next week and a half, they were negotiating over the top, you know, who get what ministries. And the Kurds have been demanding they get control of the oil ministry, which, of course, the Shiites did not want them to have. So finally, the Kurds did back up and give in and not demand oil ministries.
And now the new prime minister, Jafari, a member of the Shiite coalition of cleric Ali al-Sistani. Jafari also has close ties to Iran and the Dawah Party, which has called for the implementation of Islamic law. What's been reaction to his appointment?
Well, the people here, I mean, Jafari was essentially almost named prime minister of almost 2 months ago when the Shiite list that he's from nominated him. Because the Shiite list has a majority of seats in the assembly, everyone knew that pretty much whoever they chose to be prime minister was going to be in. Jafari himself, while he lived in Syria and Iran, also did live in London and is a doctor. But while he wears a suit and, of course, speaks English, he is, while moderate, is still very much an Islamist and will be a big proponent of using Islamic Sharia law in the constitution and governing Iraq. Mm. The degree to which he'll push for that, though, we have to wait and see.
Well, you mentioned that the biggest issues that had to be put aside in order for this to happen had to do with some of the demands of the Kurds. Now, the president and the head of the president's council is a Kurd. How is he expecting to get along? How are you seeing him in the brief time get along with the Shiite prime minister?
Well, the Kurds and the Shiites, I mean, it's sort of a, you know, they're sort of holding their noses while they're holding their hands with each other. And they're not, these are two very different groups of people that are forced to work together because they were required to have 2/3 of the majority of the assembly vote for president. In order to do that, the Shiites and the Kurds, who are the two largest groups in the assembly, had to get along and agree on a president. Now, the president is in a ceremonial position, and what he's been actually really coming out with a message of unity, which is significant because Kurds in the past have been very much sort of nationalist toward Kurdistan, toward their northern region. But in the end, you know, the Kurds still have a lot of their key demands have only been delayed until the time of the constitution or after writing the constitution. So that's going to be a real difficult time when they finally do address these issues in a final way.
How are the Kurds getting along with each other?
Well, that's the other thing that's going on, too, which is interesting. They're fighting, of course. You know, there's two groups, the KDP and the PUK. The KDP is a much more extreme nationalist group. The PUK, which is Talabani's party, is a little more open-minded, progressive, a little more practical. And the PUK won a lot of the power in the new government. The KDP did not, and now the KDP is actually making more demands on the Shiites to get other ministries. They're even renewing their demand for the oil ministry now. You know, in the end, they're going to have to get along, and they're going to have to realize that they have to work together if they're going to move forward. So I think they're causing a little dust storm right now, but it may not really amount to much.
And by the way, there is a deadline in August for the actual writing of the Constitution. Does everyone think they'll make it?
Probably not. The deadline is August 15th to write it, and then the country can have a referendum October 15th. But if the authors are slow, and they can ask for a one-time 6-month extension, which would push the entire process, of course, back 6 months, which is probably likely now because they've been so slow to form the government, which really wasn't even the most important work they're supposed to be doing. The Constitution is the real work that they're supposed to be doing. So it'll probably get delayed. We'll have to see, though.
Right. We should mention that President Talabani has offered an amnesty aimed at the Sunni Muslims, which we haven't mentioned that population. They didn't participate heavily in the elections. Will the formation of the government maybe ease some of those bruised feelings?
Well, that's kind of the problem. I mean, the Sunnis, the problem with the Sunnis is that everyone knows they need to include them in the government because this insurgency is Sunni-led. And they know that the only reason, only way you're going to sort of quell the insurgency is by including them in the political process. The problem is you have a bunch of disparate groups and a wide range of Sunnis, from the most extreme insurgent leaders to very westernized people that are you'd hardly even call them Sunni. They're so secular and so westernized. So the problem is finding one leader, one spokesman, or even a handful of spokespeople for this very diverse group, and it hasn't really happened yet. We're still going to wait and see if they can bring in the really top insurgent leaders into this. If they succeed in doing that, then that'll be a big step forward. Mm-hmm. If not, we could face more problems down the road with the Sunnis.
And Jill, just briefly, in the few seconds we have, what's the feeling in Baghdad today after these historic images coming of new leaders shaking hands? Does it resonate in the neighborhoods?
Yeah, people are really happy. I mean, people were getting very frustrated. I mean, really, really angry at them for not forming government. So now this has happened. People are excited. They have hope. They feel like something is finally happening. But of course, like after the election, these feelings can dissipate quite quickly if there's any change on the ground or isn't more progress made. And if a month or 2 months from now, we still have very little, no security, no electricity, no constitution is really coming out in any kind of productive way. We could see people once again losing this sort of democratic euphoria they have, and that could be dangerous also as far as, gaining support toward the insurgency.
Jill Carroll writes for the Christian Science Monitor. She's speaking to us from Baghdad. Jill, thanks.
Thank you.
Across a packed St. Peter's Square today, thousands of people were chanting Santo, 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 Giovanni Paolo Santo, as Pope John Paul II was laid to rest. They were calling on the Catholic Church to make their beloved late Pope a saint. 300,000 people filled St. Peter's Square in Vatican City for John Paul's funeral mass. Millions more watched on giant video screens throughout Rome. Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger, a close confidant of the Pope and a possible successor, presided at the mass. The German cardinal spoke in heavily accented Italian, which was translated into English.
We entrust your dear soul to the Mother of God, your mother, who guided you every day and who will guide you now to the eternal glory of her Son, our Lord Jesus Christ. Amen.
Christopher Dickey is Paris Bureau Chief and Middle East Regional Editor for Newsweek magazine. He joins us now from Rome. And Christopher, we've been seeing the pictures of the massive crowds earlier today. I'm just wondering what images are just still staying with you.
Well, it's been an incredibly moving experience to be here over the course of the last several days. Not just the crowds today, but the incredibly long lines on Thursday, where they were not only stretching all the way down the Via della Conciliazione, which is the main avenue leading to the Vatican and to St. Peter's Square, but all through the streets of the neighborhoods, across the bridges, across the Tiber, and all down along the banks of the Tiber, and very, very well-behaved crowds, people who knew what they were here to do, who didn't want to cause any trouble, who didn't cause any trouble, and very well-managed crowds by the Italian and the Vatican police.
And today, we couldn't help but know the very simple wooden coffin that was laid out for the Mass. After the funeral Mass, we understand Pope John Paul was buried among past popes in the bare ground, as he requested, in the grotto under St. Peter's Basilica, but in three coffins. Why is that?
Well, that's a matter of tradition. First of all, they're not going to bury him just in a simple wooden coffin. I'm not sure how deeply they could bury him either, but they surrounded that coffin with another coffin made of zinc and wood and basically sealed it up tight, more or less like a conventional coffin that you would see in any American funeral. And that's how they buried him.
Right. Will pilgrims be able to view the coffin and where the Pope is laid to rest?
No, they'll certainly be able to view where he's laid to rest. They won't be able to view the coffin, no.
Right, because it's buried. Well, this was a solemn occasion, a funeral mass for a world figure and a religious leader, also a huge political event, a remarkable array of world leaders, royalty, but a lot of tensions between some of those leaders. So who sat where?
Well, there was a lot of interesting proximity, and there was a particularly interesting moment during the service where everybody was supposed to stand up and shake hands and embrace, and all of a sudden you had the president of Israel, Moshe Katsav, shaking hands with Mohammad Khatami, the president of Iran, and Bashar al-Assad, the president of Syria, two of Israel's worst enemies. That was certainly sort of the strange handshake of the day, or interesting handshake of the day. You also had Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe, who apparently detests Tony Blair, and I'm sure the emotion is shared by Blair, also shaking hands in that environment. So it was definitely a scene of good fellowship, and certainly a little political exploitation, but many people tried to take advantage of it.
Well, by the way, Mugabe sidestepped a European Union travel ban to attend the funeral because the ban apparently doesn't apply to the Vatican. And we also learned today that apparently Vatican officials came up with an alphabetical solution to the seating issue. They put the world leaders alphabetical by the country's name in French. So there was no attempt to put world leaders together, although, as you said, it brought them together. We were just wondering, is there any sense yet of whether or not this was the largest gathering of world leaders in one place? We're trying to remember where there might have been another scene like this. This large.
I certainly can't remember another one that's this big, or with crowds, not just world leaders, or crowds that were this big. I mean, we're talking about millions of people who tried to attend this funeral. And it's very interesting that some 20 of the countries represented, there are more than 100 countries represented, and some 20 of them were, in fact, mostly Muslim countries. I think there were 12 Muslim heads of state or heads of government here.
Mm-hmm. And what did you see in the crowds that struck you? I, of course, noticed a lot of Polish flags and a lot of, as we were saying, a lot of calls for sainthood. What did you notice?
Look, I mean, it was like all of Poland came to Rome. I mean, there's a huge Polish contingent and a lot of Polish flags, but there were also flags that you wouldn't necessarily expect. The flag of India was one of the ones that was being waved. Flag of Pakistan was waving above the crowd. There were a lot of flags from all over the world, Croatia, Brazil, the United States of America. And there were people of all walks in the crowd. There were a lot of Africans, African priests and nuns, and also Africans who were not in the clergy were in the crowd. So it was truly a global celebration, if you will. I think that is really the thing that was most striking about it when you were on the ground in the middle of the people, is the exaltation, not just the sense of mourning. Mm-hmm. Several times the crowd broke into applause, and when the coffin was carried into the basilica, there was just resounding applause throughout the crowd, and not only cries of santo, saint, but just a sense that this man, who was very much revered, had gone on to meet his maker. There was really the most beautiful line in Ratzinger's homily was where he said that everybody remembered what the Pope looked like when he was standing and suffering in the window on Easter Sunday, the window that was right above St. Peter's Square, and now he was looking out from the window of his father's house.
Christopher Dickey, Paris Bureau Chief and Middle East Regional Editor for Newsweek Magazine in Rome. Christopher, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you, Robin.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Under the leadership of the late Pope John Paul II, the Roman Catholic Church grew enormously, from 757 million Catholics when the pontiff was elected in 1978 to 1.1 billion today. One of the many challenges facing the next pope will be maintaining the membership, especially in Latin America, where evangelical Christians are growing in prominence. Sister Margaret Guider is a former missionary who worked in Brazil and is now an associate professor of missiology at Weston Jesuit School of Theology in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And Sister Margaret, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And missiology, the study of missionary work?
Yeah, the study of missionary activity, the study of the mission of the church.
Well, Pope John Paul II's 1990 encyclical Mission of the Redeemer called on Catholics to spread the message. Mm-hmm. He said in part, "I wish to invite the church to renew her missionary commitment, for missionary activity renews the church, revitalizes faith and Christian identity. Faith is strengthened when it's given to others." And that would seem to say to people that missionary work is simply about spreading the message. But is it?
Contrary to depictions of missionary activity in the past, which may have been coercive in some ways, bartering or exchange, typical notion of the rice Christian, people who converted to Christianity in exchange for rice. If indeed that was an aspect of missionary activity in the past, I think it's fair to say that within the Roman Catholic Church, that no longer is the condition.
What are some of the things that Catholic missions and missionaries do around the world?
Well, I think the medical missions are a major feature here. In terms of hospices, hospitals, much work has been done in Asia and Africa and in Latin America, not only with the use of Western medicine, but also trying to help people to understand natural remedies and things like that that are more accessible to them. Different refugee services, Catholic refugee services, Jesuit refugee services have made a very important impact.
What happens when the mission of both spreading the word and helping, you know, extending a hand, it might conflict in some areas? I'm thinking, for instance, in Africa, where mm-hmm. so many have applauded the work of the Catholic Church in helping people with AIDS.
Right.
On the other hand, the Church doesn't allow for the use of condoms to prevent the spread of AIDS.
Right.
So what happens when the Church goes into areas where the help is welcomed, but maybe the doctrine isn't?
The example you give is a very critical one. On-the-ground experience is basically what raises some questions and concerns about the adequacy and the appropriateness mm-hmm. of the teaching.
It puts you, if you're in the field, in a tough position, I guess I'm hearing.
Mm-hmm.
Do missionaries wrestle with this?
I think missionaries wrestle with a number of questions. Certainly the issues around interreligious dialogue. Meaning what is the relationship of the presence of Christians in areas that are traditionally, say, Muslim
yeah.
or Sikh or Hindu or Buddhist? In what do the presence of missionaries or of Christians in those areas, what does it mean?
As we mentioned, the Catholic Church is losing ground in some places in Latin America and Brazil, which is the largest Catholic country in the world, and some say that's because of competition from evangelicals.
I think the rise in Pentecostalism, which is the particular kind of Christianity that is growing throughout Latin America, also has its charismatic dimensions in mainline churches, including the Catholic Church. I think we really need to become more media savvy. Mm-hmm. There are elements in the Roman Catholic Church, for example, if I can say the Eternal Word Television Network, that has dominated the airwaves. But that offers one vision within the Roman Catholic Church of how to communicate the message. We assume there are other formats and other visions that are open for communication. Unfortunately, those alternative visions or other visions have not effectively dominated the media. By that, I mean not only television and radio, but also the Internet.
You know, there is a perception that there, you know, that it isn't about helping people, it's about converting people when any church sets out to do mission. And in fact, a lot of the evangelical groups are doing just that. How much, for instance, I'm thinking of the post-tsunami, very aggressive evangelical Christians traveled to India, Indonesia, Sri Lanka. How much does that kind of aggressive conversion on the part of other churches hurt the Catholic Church now?
Well, I think we need to understand that individuals who engage in that kind of activity are driven by an apocalyptic urgency that is no longer shared to the extent that it once was by other Christian churches. That apocalyptic urgency, that this is their last chance, if you were to compare it with polio vaccination, for example, they're dealing with, in their belief structure, situations of ultimacy. This is their chance to effectively, from their perspective, communicate the gospel message. it is extreme behavior, but it's extreme behavior that's moved by their perception of the extreme circumstances.
Sister Margaret Guider is a former missionary who worked in Brazil and is now an associate professor of missiology at Weston Jesuit School of Theology here in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Sister Margaret, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
We want his canonization because he's the greatest saint of all 2,000 years of the church, I think. One of the greatest saints, perhaps the greatest pope we've ever had.
He traveled all over the world giving the message of Christ.
Pope was like a father. We feel such an emptiness now and we feel lost without him.
He helped me to pray and to love all the people.
He communicates peace, happiness. Just very great man.
The thoughts of just a few of the millions of people gathered in Rome today to pay their final tributes to the late Pope John Paul II. Stay with us, there's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now.
The Pope believes that the 20th century is the most evil of all of mankind's histories.
It is we who must choose between evil and good.
This week, a frontline documentary on the life of Pope John Paul II that first aired in 1999 and was updated upon his death is airing on PBS stations. Helen Whitney produced and co-wrote the film called John Paul II, The Millennial Pope, and Helen Whitney joins us from New York. Welcome.
Thank you for inviting me.
So what's your thoughts about the coverage of the Pope's death? It's been nonstop for about a week. You've immersed yourself in this man and his life. Do you think the media got it mostly right?
Well, you know, my heart went out to the commentators because I felt that they were facing so many of the challenges that I was facing as I set out to make my biography, except for I did it in quiet times and they're doing it in the heat of this wrenching event. And I think that, you know, the great challenge is how do you suggest the complexity of this man, this, you know, virtual tower of contradictions? How do you do that respectfully in this moment? How do you reveal the personal as well as the theological roots of his beliefs without trivializing him? And how do you move beyond the pieties of both the left and the right? And as the week went on, I felt that people were moving into a more searching analysis of those fascinating complexities and contradictions, and most likely next week a more focused critique will emerge.
Well, speaking of those contradictions, someone in your film spoke of that, former priest and author James Carroll. Let's listen.
He's an anti-communist, a man who succeeded in helping to bring down Soviet communism, and yet he's profoundly suspicious of democracy. He's a man of a tremendous modern sensibility, capable of being at home with rock musicians and young people, and yet he has staked everything on protecting a view of the church that has its roots in the Middle Ages.
And as a young man, you also point out and remind us, as a young man, an actor and a poet as well. Tell us about that.
As a very young man, he wrote poetry, wrote a great deal of poetry, and some of it actually is quite good, particularly the poem to his mother.
Over this your white grave, the flowers of life in white, so many years without you. How many have passed out of sight? Over this your white grave, covered for years, there is a stir in the air,
I began to think about it at the end when Eamon Duffy, Professor Eamon Duffy, a great scholar about the Vatican, related to me a personal story in which the Pope was at a dinner party and he was asked by the person sitting next to him whether he had written any poetry since he'd become Pope. And the Pope was startled and he sort of reared back and he said, "No, I've written nothing since I've been Pope." And about a half an hour later, he turned back to the man and he said, "I've not written because I have no context." And I think that's a sort of very moving and poignant story, because I think what the Pope was saying, and I think Duffy feels this, is that he was deracinated. He had to give up Poland, his whole network of connections, his community. He had to give up that solitude where great poetry is written. And this is one of the sacrifices of being a Pope.
Helen, tell me, scenes that come to mind for you. I mean, you sat with all these images for so long. What jumps out for you?
Well, I guess now what jumps out is the final images that we collected at the very end of his life, the images of him resolutely just really dying in front of us. I mean, this was a man who quite deliberately wanted to die in our faces and to say, "Do not look away. This is, you know, there is value and beauty in an old man that is dying in front of you."
I want to listen to the words of Monsignor Lorenzo Abbasette, one of the Pope's aides. Here's the Pope's aide speaking of that moment.
"Now, he can barely say a word. He's drooling. The body is out of control, headed directly to the final moment. And still, he sets aside his assistants because he wants the world to see. To see this final encounter with the ultimate question."
Well, your film leaves the viewer with what's called a disturbing question. It's posed by former Washington Post Vatican correspondent Roberto Serro, and I'm going to paraphrase it. He says, "There's a tragedy at the heart of John Paul II's papacy. Either the world is as dark as he believed it was, which is a tragedy for the world, or John Paul is far too pessimistic about the state of the world, in which case he himself was the tragic figure." Your thoughts?
Well, you know, I've been struck that the Pope's very harsh and stark critique of the modern world is something that I don't think people really hear. Sometimes people mention his criticism of our materialism and the pursuit of, you know, of youth and power as a kind of slap on our wrists. And I think the Pope looks around and he says, "I think the spiritual death that comes out of men lose and women losing themselves in the quest for riches and this ever-increasing gap between rich and poor," which he finds an obscenity. He said, this is a man who's saying, this is terrible. And I sometimes feel the way people discuss it, they haven't really heard it. It's so sharply stated and so, you know, and so dark and so pessimistic.
They don't realize that they are being judged and judged harshly.
Judged and judged harshly.
Helen Whitney produced and co-wrote the documentary John Paul II, The Millennial Pope. It's airing on PBS stations this week. Helen Whitney, thanks so much.
And thank you for bringing me on the show.
And for more information on where the film is airing, go to our website, here-now.org. And some more notes from today's funeral for Pope John Paul II. People around the world watched the massive event on television. In the Pope's native Poland, about 800,000 people crowded the same field in Krakow where John Paul returned triumphant to his home country after he was first elevated. Poles watched the proceedings on huge video screens, the country more or less shut down, schools and businesses closing in honor of the Holy Father, who was a native son. In China, John Paul's death has united that country's Catholics
in mourning. Thousands were expected at a government-sponsored mass. The Catholic Church in China is divided between a state-sponsored church and an underground congregation. The Pope's passing is fueling speculation that Beijing might ease its rejections of ties between Chinese Catholics and Rome. Still to come, composer John Harbison reflects on what it's like to compose for the late Pope. You're listening to Here and Now. Prince Charles attended the Pope's funeral today as the representative of the Queen. Then the prince jetted back to Britain to prepare for his own wedding, which was delayed a day because of the funeral. As that wedding approaches, we thought we'd check in with Here and Now's Michael Goldfarb in London. Michael, we know that the Queen is holding a reception for Prince Charles and Camilla Parker Bowles, but not attending the ceremony, which will start with only 28 family members at City Hall?
Well, there are city halls, and there are city halls, Robin. They're going to the Guildhall in Windsor, which is an ancient town overlooking the Thames. But basically, they'll be doing what any other couple getting married for the second time, what they do. They go to a registry office, they take their vows in front of a registrar, and their witnesses sign papers, and they are legally married. But then after that, they will proceed up the great grand drive to Windsor Castle, and there they'll be joined by 700 of their most intimate friends to celebrate a service of blessing. This is the way they do it now in the Church of England. It's a way of getting around the fact that both of them are divorcees.
Well, we understand that with that in mind, Charles and his bride, Camilla Parker Bowles, are going to be reading the strongest statement of penitence from the Book of Common Prayer. Tell us about that.
That's right. Well, there was a call about a week ago from a senior Anglican cleric saying that it was wrong for the prince to get married without publicly acknowledging his faults in his first marriage. That kind of laid out there, it was blared across as a tabloid headline. And sure enough, in the last 24 hours, it's been announced that they will read this passage from the Book of Common Prayer. And it is really quite an extraordinary statement. You know, when we think of the royal family, we often think of a kind of mindless arrogance. But it is, I think, comes out of a sense that the public may still feel, at least in the back of their hearts, some sense that Prince Charles wasn't entirely fair to his first wife.
It reads in part, "We acknowledge and bewail our manifold sins and wickedness, which we from time to time most grievously have committed by thought, word, and deed." It goes on later, "We do earnestly repent and are heartily sorry for these misdoings." That's not exactly a festive moment at a wedding, but...
No, it's not, but I mean, he is a public figure, and I'm certain that his advisors felt that something like this was needed to get the British public on side. Although, having said that, Robin, my impression here is that people are pretty much accepting of this.
Yeah, I was wondering, how much are people paying attention to the upcoming wedding?
Well, not much, to be honest. The wedding is being held tomorrow along with one of the key events of the British sporting calendar, which is the Grand National Steeplechase Race at Aintree Racecourse up near Liverpool. And sports columnists this week have been wagering in the press about which event, both of them are televised by the BBC, which event will draw the bigger audience. And most people say the odds-on favorite to draw more viewers will be the big steeplechase race.
Which brings up the question of the future of the monarchy, and we're going to explore that next week. But it also reminds us the wedding was pushed back a day, and we're wondering what happened to all the wedding memorabilia that, you know, vendors were hoping to sell. We found one cup, Michael, online. It's a sticker, actually, that can convert your 1981 Charles and Diana wedding mug into a Charles and Camilla mug.
Well, you know, Robin, the only people really who benefited from the change of date were the purveyors of merchandise. There's this whole subculture here of people who buy tea mugs with the pictures of the royal couple emblazoned on it, and tea towels, very big tea towels here. And, you know, this marriage just wasn't exciting anyone. But by having to change the date, suddenly all of these items that nobody was buying now have collector's value. Sort of like that 1905 buffalo head nickel where the buffalo is upside down. So, in fact, the purveyors of this tat may actually make some money off it now.
Here now is Michael Goldfarb speaking to us from London. By the way, what's the weather supposed to be?
Well, they say happy the bride, the sun shines on, but I believe that tomorrow it's going to be a resurgence of cold, wintry rain. This couple, they've been waiting 30 years to finally get married, and they're just not getting any help at all.
Michael, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. It's hard to believe that Mahler's Second Symphony, Resurrection, was rejected when it was first performed in the late 1800s. The harmonies were too unfamiliar. And as conductor Leonard Bernstein said much later, it hit too close to home, touched too deeply on people's concerns about life and death. It was simply too true. But Mahler's Second has, of course, since been embraced, and in fact was chosen by the Vatican to be the centerpiece of last year's commemoration of the 25th anniversary of John Paul's elevation to Pope. The theme of the evening was reconciliation, honoring the Pope's lifelong commitment to bringing faiths together. The Pope's musical advisors were looking for a composer to write a modern companion to the Mahler. After hearing the music of Pulitzer Prize-winning John Harbison, they asked him to write the piece that would become Abraham. The Pittsburgh Symphony, performing John Harbison's Abraham before the Pope in January 2004. Harbison is also a professor at MIT here in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and he joins us now. Hello.
Thank you.
And how did you come to write this piece, Abraham, for the Pope?
Well, the Pope had been for many years associated with an American conductor, Gilbert Levine, now Sir Gilbert Levine. He's a papal knight.
He's actually been called the Pope's conductor.
Yes, he has. This is at least in the press. And he suggested apparently right away that I be asked to contribute, to write some sort of a piece for this occasion. A short piece which would introduce, I guess, the themes of the event and for forces similar in some ways to the Mahler Symphony, that is a chorus and then the large brass section.
What kind of guidelines were you given? Were you told that the name had to be Abraham, or did you choose that?
Well, I think originally there was another process which was more close to the political world that I apparently had to be vetted in terms of my personal background so that it wouldn't turn up that I was a, you know, petty or large-scale criminal or something that was writing this piece for such an occasion. Mm-hmm. I think it's the first time that that sort of process was ever introduced as well into the commissioning of a musical work. And then also I think the Pope needed to be assured that I was in some way active previously in the field of sacred music. And then I submitted three texts, two modern poems by Catholic writers, and the biblical text, and they chose the biblical text.
And the biblical text is from Genesis?
Yes. It says, and when Abraham was 99 years and nine, the Lord appeared and said, I am the Almighty God, walk before me and be thou perfect. Thou shalt be the father of many nations. And this is, of course, the theme, the common theme of the three central religious branches which were involved in this particular event. A number of rabbis and a number of mullahs were on stage with the Pope at the concert. The occasion was an occasion in which really the the concert element was part of it, but I think it was also very much part of a kind of communal meditation on these themes. It also was, in certain sense, obviously a kind of celebration of this general initiative that the Pope had been furthering for so many years. He'd been extremely tenacious in certain themes, and one of them was the effort to try to get different religious groups to talk to each other.
What was it like to hear it played there in the presence of the Pope?
It was very exciting because, of course, it was also a huge audience. I think it was the biggest indoor audience I've ever been part of for a concert piece. About 11,000 people. Mm. It was in the big audience hall of the Vatican, and it was a tremendous crowd. And then, of course, there was a major surprise at the end of the event, which is that the Pope, who had not been scheduled to make any remarks because his health during that period had been before that quite shaky, he did give a quite extended and extremely clearly delivered speech in Italian, where he mentioned both pieces and seemed to be speaking somewhat extemporizing.
What did he say of yours?
He spoke of both pieces as embodying the themes of his initiative, and spoke of me and Mahler as if we're absolute brothers under the skin, which of course I enjoyed a lot.
I read you were raised a Lutheran. In fact, did I read your father was an expert on the Reformation?
Well, I sort of appointed myself a Lutheran. My father was a Luther and Calvin expert. He was a Reformation scholar, but he was Presbyterian, and our family was Presbyterian. But I kind of adopted Lutheranism because of Bach and Schütz and the music that I was interested in when I was young.
Because of the music. But, you know, given that, you know, not a Catholic, but still, to have your music performed for the Pope, dedicated to the Pope, saluted by the Pope, what your thoughts?
Well, I was very amazed that the Pope's aesthetic sense played such a role in his view of big world issues. This was tremendously exciting. I can't think of a modern patron who would carry both such traditional significance and also such immediate alertness to what I really think are the powers of the arts. I mean, obviously he was in his early career an actor and writer and poet, and some of that carries through, but just a couple weeks before this event, he issued a statement about the use of the arts in the church, which said it was time for the Catholic Church to return to or to make more use of its great musical heritage, which in a sense is a kind of reversal of the Vatican Congress of John the 22nd, which moved sort of more towards vernacular arts, folk music and so forth, because the Pope was saying we have Gregorian chant and we have our great polyphonic tradition, and let's think about that again. And, of course, I was tremendously excited by that because it's always seemed to me that sacred music is, in principle, a very neglected field.
As you've said, you walk into so many churches now and there's a couple of guys with guitars, which is nice.
That's fine, but I think that we composers, and I speak for the sort of fraternity and sorority of concert composers, that we're missing a lot of chances to reach an audience in a very different way than we might in the concert world.
John Harbison, thank you so much for giving us some of your time today. We really appreciate it.
You're very welcome.
The Pittsburgh Symphony, with choirs from London, Poland, and Turkey, performing John Harbison's Abraham for Pope John Paul II in January of 2004.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Our production team includes Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Kevin Sullivan, Matt Largy, Emiko Tamagawa, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna. Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Bob Connolly. Our web producer is Ken George. Our newscast producer, Deborah Becker. Interns are Kate Goldring and Danielle Dreilinger. Special thanks today to MPR's Symphony Cast for providing John Harbison's Abraham. The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.